Good afternoon, everyone. It's officially afternoon as of right this second. I'm Corby Comer, longtime senior editor of The Atlantic, and I have the privilege of running Ideas, the magazine of the Aspen Institute, where I'm launching a program on food and food policy and food and society at the Aspen Institute. Few people are more central to the lives of the Institute and of the country, I would argue, than David Rubenstein, who we're lucky enough to hear from today. He, after being co-CEO and founding the Carlyle Group, has put his money to work in a way we were lucky enough to hear him talk about with Walter Isaacson a few months ago at the Institute, in a way he can see, feel, touch, and understand before he dies. He's interested in projects he can follow that will be taken to completion in his lifetime that he sees. And if you have admired the beauty of the restoration of the Washington Monument, or the Lincoln Monument, or any number of other monuments, more of which he'll become intimately involved with because he's the CEO of the chair of the board of the Smithsonian, it is thanks to David's generosity. If you visited Monticello, visited the centers, if you understand the way Monticello has reinvented itself, it is thanks to this gentleman. So he also is a scholar on the Founding Fathers, a frighteningly adept interviewer, as those of us who just heard him interview Jeffrey Seller, the producer of Rent, and now Hamilton, understand. He asked all the questions that we wanted to know about the creation of Hamilton, how it has changed the producer's life. If you watch him every week on his show on PBS and Bloomberg, you'll understand just how he goes right for the core. We're about to hear from him about core principles of the country, the Founding Fathers, and there's a special appetizer based on 100th birthday. We're lucky enough to hear from David.
Thank you very much. So, how many people have never been to the Aspen Ideas Festival before? Anybody? Okay. How many people have been coming for 5 years or more? Okay. How many people here are from the East Coast of the United States, the West Coast, Midwest, South, outside the United States? Oh, okay.
Mountain West.
All right, where?
Mountain West.
Mountain West. How many people from the Mountain West? Okay. All right, and how many people are having a good time so far? Okay. So what I'd like to do is talk about two subjects. One is the one that was advertised, and I don't want to mislead people, because what was advertised, what I'm going to talk about, which was the topic of are the Founding Fathers overrated? And all of us have some views on probably that. But I like to give what was just called an appetizer because I am in one of my side jobs, the chairman of the Kennedy Center. And this is the 100th birthday of President Kennedy this year. And for all of us who may have lived through his lifetime, or some of us, if I remember, does anybody here that lived through it doesn't remember where they were when he was killed? Everybody remembers that, I assume. You weren't alive, okay? All right, for those who, how many people were alive? How many people remember where they were when they heard? So I was in the 10th grade, I remember exactly, my teacher came and told me that he'd been assassinated, school was over, and then we began 4 days of tragic mourning. I would like to just talk at the beginning, before I get to the Founding Fathers, something about President Kennedy. His 100th birthday was celebrated May the 29th, 2017. He was born, of course, 100 years earlier. It's hard to believe he would have been 100 years old had he lived. Let me just talk about one thing that I'm always fascinated about, which some of you may have a similar fascination, I hope, and interest in. When I was in the sixth grade, we didn't go to school on Inauguration Day. And I went home. We had a black and white television. Some of you may have had color televisions. I'm not sure they had that many then. And I watched his inaugural address. And some of you may have watched this as well. And it was an inaugural address that my teacher the next day went through with me word for word, line for line, with the other students as well. And I realized it was really poetry in prose form. Because you know that John Kennedy famously asked, in the speech, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And that inspired me to try to do something for my country. Ultimately, as some of you may have heard, I did go in government, managed to get inflation to 19%. And since that time, I've been trying to atone for those sins. and trying to work my way back into God's good graces for having gotten inflation so high. But I was really President Kennedy who inspired me and many others to go into the into government service or public service. And I just want to talk for a few minutes about that famous speech, because some of you probably remember it. Some of you have heard it many times since then. How did it come about? How did somebody who wasn't a gifted speechmaker come up with a brilliant speech like that? Well, let me just give you a little background. President Kennedy actually was very unusual that he actually got elected president, because while you might think the current president is somebody who was unusual to have been elected president, President Kennedy had some things that happened in his life that made it unusual to think he would ever be president. He was given the last rites of the Catholic Church 3 times. He almost died in World War II, as you know. He almost died several other times from back problems and other problems. He had Addison's disease and some other things that were fairly debilitating. His brother had died in World War II, and the brother was the really outgoing person, Joseph Kennedy Jr. He was the one that people thought would be the political candidate. President Kennedy actually wanted to be a journalist, probably more than anything else. He ultimately came back when his brother died, ran for Congress. As you know, he ran and won, but he wasn't that accomplished as a member of the House. He ran for the Senate against Henry Cabot Lodge in 1952 and won, even though he really didn't have that great of accomplishments in the House of Representatives, but he had the name and his father was wealthy. But when he ran for president, people thought he could never be elected president. Why? Because he was Catholic. There had never been a Catholic president. There had only been one nominee of a major party, Al Smith from New York. And so people thought, how can a Catholic be elected president? And Eisenhower was fairly popular. And people thought that while Nixon had his challenges, Eisenhower probably would be able to push him across. And in fact, it was a very, very close election. And in many ways, Eisenhower might have been able to do more to help the vice president. But Kennedy won, maybe because of the debates. Those are the first presidential debates. There have never been presidential debates before. The famous Lincoln-Douglas debates were Senate debates. They were not presidential debates. And you know, it's not clear that that President Kennedy would have been able to get elected had he not won that first presidential debate. But in any event, he gets elected, and in those days, there were no elaborate transitions. Today, we have elaborate transitions with hundreds of people working on them, lots of money from the federal government. In those days, no money was expended by the federal government for transitions, and so President Kennedy ran his transition out of his Georgetown townhouse. And people would come and go, and all the reporters were there. They could see who he was interviewing, and they could figure out who might be getting jobs. Eventually, he moved down to Palm Beach, where his father had a home, and he was kind of working out of there to get more privacy. And ultimately, he picked a cabinet of people he really didn't really know very well, except his brother. And then he began around November to work on his inaugural address. And he had a young man that he'd hired named Ted Sorensen, he'd hired when Ted Sorensen was about 25 years old. Ted Sorensen was from Nebraska. Very liberal family in Nebraska, well known in Nebraska. He got a job on Capitol Hill. Scoop Jackson interviewed him, didn't hire him. John Kennedy hired him, and he became the intellectual blood bank for President Kennedy. And he became kind of a mind meld where he would be able to understand what Kennedy wanted. He could write in great eloquent ways what Kennedy wanted to say. And Kennedy became to be known for giving fairly nice speeches, and he wrote a book, Profiles in Courage, that probably was helped a lot by Ted Sorensen, who actually got all the royalties for it. So it was a case where you had a young, gifted speechwriter, and I think in hindsight, Ted Sorensen was probably the most gifted presidential speechwriter we've ever had. And he was given the assignment then at age of 31, and it's hard to believe how young John Kennedy was. He was only 43 years old when he was elected. And Jackie Kennedy was only 31 when she was first lady. And she looked old to me somebody who was 11 or 12 years old, but she was only 31 years old. And when he was assassinated, just 34 years old. He was given this assignment by President-elect Kennedy to write an inaugural address. And he was told by President-elect, say, go through all the previous inaugural addresses and see what made them work. Go through the Gettysburg address, see what made that work. And Sorensen did that, and he kind of said that he realized what would make these things work, and obviously one of the key things was shortness. Short speeches work better than long speeches, and so forth. William Henry Harrison knew that better than anybody else because he gave a long speech upon his inauguration, and it was raining, and he died 30 days later from the flu he caught from giving too long a speech. There were many people around John Kennedy who wanted to write that speech. John Kenneth Galbraith was a Harvard professor, later became ambassador to India. He wanted to write the speech, and he actually wrote a speech and turned it in. It didn't really get to be the main speech. Arthur Schlesinger was an advisor. He gave a lot of input. Adlai Stevenson, who wanted to be Secretary of State but didn't get that job, but he was giving advice. And there were a lot of people. But in the end, Ted Sorensen wrote it. And it's interesting, what he did is that speech was only 14 minutes in length, 14 minutes. And it's very short. And in it, interestingly, President Kennedy did not actually use the word I. The most common word in the English language is I. He didn't use that. He didn't actually promise to do any single thing, which is a good thing in a speech, not to promise anything. He didn't actually talk about any domestic legislation at all at any point. He ended, as many great speeches end, the Gettysburg Address, Martin Luther King's address, and this one, using God references. But he used a mnemonic device, or a sort of a rhetorical device, that is the most famous part of that speech. And it's a device called antithesis. And an example, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. Or let us never fear to negotiate, so forth. And those kind of devices where he sets up something where he says, don't do this, but maybe you should do this. That was the device that kind of worked. And also, it was a very Cold War speech. And it was very, very focused on foreign policy. But by not asking, not mentioning any specific thing, he didn't upset anybody. By not dealing with any domestic issues, really, except briefly one, he didn't upset anybody. And it was a speech that lived on for the ages. Kennedy was not a gifted speech maker. What he did is he had many speech coaches, but they always said to him, you have to look up. He was always looking down, and all people in the audience could see was the big shock of hair. And they kind of worked through many times of getting him to learn how to speak up and to speak in a tone that people could understand. He talked even faster than I talk. And so he worked on it for quite a while. In this speech, what happened was Sorensen went through a few drafts. And there was always a debate, who wrote these speeches? Was it John Kennedy or was it Ted Sorensen? And the Kennedy family was very sensitive to it, and maybe understandably so, because when the Profiles in Courage was written, it was later charged by Drew Pearson, a gossip columnist or muckraker columnist in Washington, that was actually written by Ted Sorensen. Joe Kennedy threatened to sue. Drew Pearson took back his column. But ultimately, in the end, Ted Sorensen got all the royalties. And the reason that it was said that that President Kennedy didn't write it was because he was in the hospital at the time it was written. People didn't think he could have written it and so forth. I think what he actually did from Profiles in Courage and this speech, the inaugural addresses, he would give ideas to Sorensen, and he would review what Sorensen wrote, and then he would edit it a bit. Now, today, we don't expect presidents of the United States, senators, governors, or many, many people to write their own speeches if they're very prominent. In those days, it was considered important to show that you actually wrote your own speech, to show that you actually knew what you were talking about. And Kennedy was seen as not that intellectually heavy, and so he really didn't like that image, and he wanted to have people think he was intellectually heavy, so he wanted people to think he wrote Profiles in Courage, wrote his inaugural address. So one of the ways that he tried to convince people that he had written it was this. He had gotten a lesson from FDR. FDR did not write his speeches either. FDR was not considered by most people who knew him a great intellect. So when he was having his first inaugural address, he actually had the speech written by a person named Raymond Moley. And Raymond Moley wrote the speech, and what FDR did is he took the speech and then wrote it out in longhand. The exact speech he wrote it as longhand. He then was able to sell it for $100,000 later on for as being his speech in his own handwriting. And John Kennedy remembered that, and he said to Ted Sorensen once, you know, this speech could be worth a lot of money at the original. So, you know, he wanted to make sure people knew that he was involved in it. But what happened was around 2 or 3 days before the inauguration, President Kennedy is flying back from Palm Beach to get ready for the inauguration. And he's flying back on the plane called Caroline, which is the plane that his father had, in fact, rented for him. And he calls Hugh Seide into the back part of the plane where the cabin was. And he said to Hugh Seide, who was then the columnist from New York for the Time magazine, he said, Hugh, I'm working on my inaugural address. Here, what do you think of it? And Hugh Seide said, oh, my God, 2 days before the inauguration, he's still writing a speech, and he's asking me what I think of it? Well, it actually was a little bit of a show because the speech had already been completed. But what President Kennedy did is he wrote it out in longhand, a few pages, showed it to Hugh Seide, and Hugh Seide thought he had seen the original draft that was still being worked on. So later he wrote, obviously President Kennedy wrote the speech, I saw that in longhand, I saw him write it, I saw his speech. So he wrote about it. It was many years later that there was some concern about whether, in fact, Ted Sorensen had written it or not, and Mrs. Kennedy asked that Ted Sorensen burn the original draft of it, which he did. I think he worked on it quite a bit, and President Kennedy had some input on it. But it's an interesting thing. That speech was the most famous presidential inaugural address, I think, of the 20th century, possibly tied with FDR's first inaugural address. But people still talk about it today because it inspired people. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And it was a speech that, you know, really inspired me and maybe many of you to kind of think about what you could do for your country. And even though today the speech is seen as too much of a Cold War speech, it wasn't really written by President Kennedy completely, he delivered that speech. And Ted Sorensen's view always was, whoever delivers a speech, it's really their speech. I worked for Ted Sorensen for a few years when I was practicing law, and it was his view that if a politician gives a speech, he owns that speech, whether he wrote it or not. And so he thought it was a little unfair to criticize President Kennedy for not having written every word of that speech. Anyway, I just think when you go back and look at that speech and you sometimes read it, you see, you take a sense of how great it really was. And anyway, I just wanted to note this for the fact that it was the 100th birthday of President Kennedy, and that speech is what inspired me to maybe get involved in things that relating to President Kennedy, like the Kennedy Center, the Kennedy School, and so forth. And it still passes the test of time, because even today, while the speech is a bit of a Cold War speech, it really is poetry in prose form. And all of you have a chance to go back and read it. I think you'll be inspired by it. And so let me get on to the subject that you all came to hear about, not that speech. It's whether the Founding Fathers are overrated. Let me talk about this a moment. When we went to grade school, all of us were told how great George Washington was, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and we were given, you know, the kind of usual things that kids get in grade school. And people in those days, when we were probably in grade school, many of us, we get the kind of rhetoric and history about how these wonderful men had created this incredible country. And I have no doubt that they deserve a lot of credit. And I always wondered, though, were they as good as we thought? Now, it is said that no man is a hero to his valet. By that I mean, and this phrase means, if you get to know somebody too much, you know all their faults. You know, no valet doesn't know the faults of the person for whom he's the valet, because you see the personal interactions of a person. You see maybe a person at his or her worst. And so, you know, I wondered whether, if in fact you actually went back and examined the Founding Fathers, would you say that they were actually so great, and did they have flaws, and maybe they may have been overrated? Now, in recent years, the world of history has become much more expansive, and has done a much better job of going back and looking at the papers of these founders, learning more about their letters, and we have much more extensive things than when I was in grade school, so there's much more written about them, and we know much more about them. And so one of the questions I've often asked myself is, think about this. We had some founding fathers, we call them. Founding fathers is a phrase that really began in the 19th century. It means many different things. Some people think it means only reference to the four or five or six most important of the founding fathers. Some people think it makes a reference to 20 or so people. And then, of course, in recent years, we have a thing called founding mothers, which are the people who were the wives of these founding fathers. And some of them were very actively involved in helping, you know, their husbands. In those days, obviously, women were not allowed to participate in government affairs. They couldn't vote and so forth. But many of them were obviously so influential, and I'll talk about in a moment. So the founding fathers that I wanted to talk about are George Washington, most famous of them, Thomas Jefferson, perhaps the second most famous, John Adams, who was second president of the United States, James Madison, and Benjamin Franklin. Now, I could talk about John Jay and George Mason. I can talk about them briefly, but let me just, because of the time, just focus on a couple of these. And think about what these people did with the help of many others. They decided to break away from England, and that was actually pretty impressive when you think about it, because they were committing treason. And when you think about it, they were committing treason. These are people who would have been hung, without doubt, had they been captured by the British. The British were very upset about this. The British thought they could win this war relatively quickly, because we were, at the time, 13 colonies. The 13 colonies had no relation with each other. When the First Continental Congress was held in 1774 in Philadelphia, more people who came to that Continental Congress had gone to London than had ever been to Philadelphia. The colonies were separate. They reported to London, more or less. They didn't report to each other. There was virtually no relationship between them. And so the idea that these 13 colonies would be able to unite and actually beat the greatest military force in the world was hard to believe. At no point did we have more than 20,000 militia and soldiers under George Washington. The British had 42,000 soldiers at one point in the United States and 30,000 Hessians. So they had 72,000 soldiers, and we had no more than 20,000 even in time. And of course, our soldiers didn't have shoes in many cases. They didn't have clothing. They weren't being compensated for several years. The idea that they could actually beat the British was not really believed at the beginning or during the middle of the war or really towards the end of the war. People, and George Washington never really won very many battles. We won the war, but we didn't win many battles. The idea that these people would come together and be able to create a whole country and revolt and successfully revolt against England, that's pretty impressive when you think about what they did and the risks they took. Because when George Washington became the general, he thought that Mount Vernon would certainly be burned by the British and his everything that he had owned would be destroyed. And all the other founding fathers thought the same thing when they signed the Declaration of Independence. So the idea that these people came together and created a country by winning a war, that's pretty impressive. But then, as we all know, the war that they won, it was kind of a hollow victory in the beginning because they were operating under the Articles of Confederation, which said each of the colonies could do pretty much what they wanted. There was no central Congress that had the ability to impose taxation. If you wanted to raise revenue under the Articles of Confederation, you had to ask the state to try to raise the revenue, but you had no ability to actually impose it. So we had a very weak government, and many people thought, including many of the people who had fought the Revolutionary War, that this country would not be able to stay afloat, and ultimately Britain would come back and take control of the country, or somebody else might take over and conquer the country. So then we had the Constitutional Convention, and that was an incredible thing that you've got. 70 people were authorized to be there, 57 actually showed up, and 39 actually signed the Constitution. The idea that you could take 39 people maybe signed it, but 57 were there, and for 4 months they would, in Philadelphia, in the sweltering heat, no air conditioning, of course, lots of flies throughout the Independence Hall. It bothered them all the time, but they had to keep the windows sealed and so forth to make sure nobody could hear what they were doing or see what they're doing, that they could come up with a constitution that actually has stood the test of time better than any other constitution in the history of the world. This constitution is still in effect. We still revere it, and we still are trying to figure out what the founding fathers want when we make decisions at the Supreme Court, because so much of what constitutional law is about is what the founding fathers actually conceived and wrote 250 some years ago. The idea that they could come up with a constitution is amazing when you think about how many other constitutions have lived or been drafted around the world, and many of them are thousands of pages. Ours is relatively short, and how many of them have been amended so many times. Ours has been relatively amended modest amounts. And then they actually created a government that actually has worked, while it's got all these problems that we know about and has had challenges that I'll address. The idea that these people could create a government that actually would then later become the government that ran the most important economy in the world, the most important military power, the most important political power, it was not something anybody would have predicted. So these individuals that I'll just talk about, some of them, what were they actually like? Well, George Washington was not educated in a traditional sense. He didn't go to college. He was educated, more or less homeschooled. He inherited a lot of money or a lot of land from his family. And then when he married Martha Custis, she was one of the wealthiest landowners. Her husband had died. He became even a bigger landowner. And so he was a pretty prominent landowner and well-respected, not considered a genius, to be honest, not considered all that intellectually heavy, but considered somebody that people would follow. He was very tall, 6'2", was considered a giant in those days. And he actually didn't have that great a military record when you think about it. He had been involved in some of the French and Indian Wars when we were working with the British on those wars, but he had mostly done what was skirmishes in the woods. He had never done open field battle. He'd never really commanded large troops. And so when he became the general at the age of 43 of our troops in Revolutionary War, many people were highly skeptical of it. In fact, John Hancock, who was the head of the Continental Congress then, actually thought that he was not qualified and that Hancock should have the job, but he didn't get it. John Adams was pushing for a Virginian to make sure that it was clear that Virginia was part of this. And so George Washington got that assignment. And while he did a job of losing a number of battles, he ultimately prevailed, and that's quite incredible. And I would say the greatest thing about George Washington is not probably his intellect, but it's this. 3 times he came to the country's forefront and did something that nobody else probably would have been able to do. He won the war as the general. We had no other people probably could have been the general to win that war. We didn't have that many military experienced people. He did it for no compensation at all, at great sacrifice to his family and so forth, and at great physical hardship. He did that, and then after it was over, he decided to do something that amazed the world. He said, I am going back to Mount Vernon. I'm giving up my commission. And people couldn't believe this. Napoleon said at the time, if it's true that George Washington is going to give up power, being the general who just won a war, and go back and retire, he's the greatest man on the face of the earth. Nobody could believe that a general could give up power, because all generals, when they won wars, they actually became, you know, the governing official and ultimately made themselves into royal family members or so forth. Washington gave it up. So you could say he helped to create the country at the beginning by winning the war. But then it was realized the Articles of Confederation weren't working, so he was importuned by James Madison and Alexander Hamilton to go and chair the Constitutional Convention, and he did that reluctantly. He didn't want to get back into public service, but he did that. And in 4 months there, he never actually said anything until the very end. He sat silently running the Constitutional Convention. Probably on the sidelines he said things, but publicly, in front of everybody else, he didn't really say very much. And it's clear that we would not have had a constitution without him. The constitution was written with him in mind. The commander-in-chief was, the president of the United States was going to be the commander-in-chief. Well, they weren't going to have the president be commander-in-chief if it hadn't been anybody else but George Washington. So clearly, he got it approved, and he made it clear that he would think that the constitution was important. He was also helpful in the ratification process. It was very complicated to get that ratified. Many states didn't want to ratify it. George Washington lent his name to it and was very helpful, particularly in the Virginia ratification, which occurred and succeeded by only one vote. And then later he invented the presidency. He became the first president, didn't want to do that. He was an old man, he said. No male in his family had ever lived past the age of 50. And he was 64, at the time he was elected president of the United States, He was over 50 years old. He assumed the job of president when he was 57, and he served for 8 years. But no male had ever lived past the age of 50 in his family. So he had some illnesses. But he took on the job and he didn't really like the job. He was thinking of quitting 3 months into it, but he ultimately served 2 terms. So you could say he was an incredible person, maybe as good as his reputation. What flaw would he have? He would have one flaw that you might mention, not that he wasn't not dealing with his intellect. He was a slave owner. He inherited slaves, and when he married his wife, they had many more slaves. And at the time of his death, he and his wife had several hundred slaves. And you can argue that, being a slave owner and tolerating that is not a great thing, and I'll address that later. But of all the founding fathers, he was the only one who actually freed his slaves upon his death. None of the other founding fathers did that, though George Washington said that his slaves were actually to be freed upon the death of his wife. Now, how would you like to be, Martha Washington sitting there? And so she kind of freed some of the slaves a lot sooner. But Thomas Jefferson was probably the most intellectual of the founding fathers in some respects, a great writer, but a terrible talker. At the age of 33, he was asked to go to the Second Continental Congress. He didn't want to go because his wife was ill. He really wanted to stay in Virginia because rewriting the Constitution of Virginia was what he thought was most important. But he went, and then he was given an assignment of writing a Declaration of Independence, as later became known as. And in the Continental Congress, they were working on what they should do. Should they withdraw from the British Empire or not? John Adams had a resolution in front of the Congress saying we should go back and get authority to withdraw, and they were going to go back to their individual states, get authority to come back and vote for the withdrawal. But anticipating that, a committee was formed of Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson were 3 of the 5 members on it, and Thomas Jefferson was actually given the assignment by John Adams of actually writing that Declaration of Independence. Like many of us, he waited till the end. He had about 18 days to write it. He waited the last 3 days to do it. And then he wrote it out, and it's pretty well clear that today what you would call it plagiarism, because he took ideas from other places and he kind of used ideas that many people had and used some of the words that other people had. But in the end, he wrote this incredible Declaration of Independence, which ultimately the Congress adopted on July the 4th. He actually was upset with the way it was edited, and in fact, for 7 or 8 years, he refused to acknowledge that he was actually the author of it. Later on his tombstone, he wanted that to be said to be the most important thing, author of the Declaration of Independence. Thomas Jefferson was probably not a great executive in many respects. He was governor of Virginia briefly and was criticized for having fled the capital when the British were invading, not really being very heroic, it was said at the time. He loved to write, but he was not a good talker. As President of the United States, he only made one public speech. He loved to write letters. We have now about 14,000 extant letters of his, but he wasn't really good at public talking. That's not necessarily a sin, but he was also a slave owner. He ran a gigantic plantation, and basically he lived off the profits of the slaves, and he had several hundred slaves. And while I think he's an incredibly talented person, he was, in hindsight, doing something that today we would say wasn't so wonderful, being a slave owner. And as some of you may know, he was also criticized by some at that time and later for having a 30-plus year relationship with one of his slaves, Sally Hemings. It's generally believed that he had fathered six children with her, and you have to say, what kind of relationship was it? Was it really voluntary on the part of Sally Hemings to have a 30-plus year relationship, six children with Thomas Jefferson, or was it not? You know, as a slave, she didn't have as much say as somebody who wasn't a slave in that kind of relationship, but he never actually commented on it. He never denied it, and it's pretty clear today from DNA evidence that it was true. So he was, a very talented man. He wrote the Declaration of Independence. It inspired people. It was incredible in terms of the preamble. As president, he was pretty successful in doing many things, the most successful of which is he, against what he would have otherwise believed should be the case, he did the Louisiana Purchase for a modest amount of money. We bought more land than we actually already had in the country, and that was his great feat, I think, as President of the United States. Today, we remember him for his intellect, the Declaration of Independence, creating the University of Virginia, and some of the things he did as president. But again, you have to look at him as a slave owner and somebody that had this, you know, complicated relationship with Sally Hemings. Alexander Hamilton, everybody today knows more about Alexander Hamilton than they did before. He was, in many ways, the most self-made of these individuals. Even Benjamin Franklin, who I'll talk about in a moment, was probably not as self-made because these Benjamin Franklin had some relatives who were alive when he was beginning his ascent in life. Alexander Hamilton, as we know, was orphaned, came to the United States on a scholarship, went to Columbia, made himself an aide to George Washington, and then ultimately became George Washington's trusted aide, Secretary of the Treasury, and ultimately built the financial system that we are still using in many ways in terms of a strong federal government, in terms of finances, and in terms of a strong credit system for the federal debts. So he's a brilliant person. If you've all seen the play or if you've read about it, you know that he had his own fatal flaws. He was against slavery, opposed it, but he, you know, his personal life was complicated by many things that he later admitted, and I think he was also considered relatively arrogant and also a person who got into fights with people like Jefferson and others and was really disruptive of the first President Washington's administration because he and Jefferson were fighting all the time. But in the end, Hamilton has some lot of great features and so forth. Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, Walter Isaacson had written a terrific book about him. You probably have read it if you've been involved with Aspen. Benjamin Franklin was a person who left his home in Boston, went made a home for himself in Philadelphia with no real education. He became a very good writer, became a world-famous scientist, helping to more or less explain electricity, became the most famous person in the United States, more famous even than George Washington, went to Europe and helped negotiate the treaty that ended the Revolutionary War, lived there for quite some time. He, you know, what's wrong with him? Well, nothing's wrong with him. He was against slavery, he was a leader against slavery. His lifestyle would be one that today people might not say was so wonderful, a bit of a libertine, He was married with a common law wife in the United States. He kind of had a common law wife in England, so he kind of had two common law wives at the same time. But we shouldn't impose today's morality, perhaps. But in what he left behind is an incredible number of inventions, and he was involved. He was the only person who signed the Declaration of Independence, signed the Constitution, and signed the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War. So he was fairly involved in many things, maybe the most self-made of these people in some respects, because what he did was not just government, but he did things in literature, he did things in science, and really, in the end, some of his scientific discoveries are still with us, and today he would have been, if he were alive, and these things happened, he would have won a Nobel Prize, probably. Let me mention James Madison. James Madison is often called the father of the Constitution, and he probably shouldn't completely be called that because it was his idea to have a constitutional convention. He pushed for it. He had a plan about how the government should be structured, but the plan that he wanted actually was never actually implemented. He wanted to have both houses of Congress be on proportionate representation, which would be good for Virginia. Ultimately, that obviously didn't happen. But he was a man who became very loyal to George Washington. In fact, when Washington was president, Madison was in the Congress. Madison would write a letter to George Washington on behalf of the Congress. Then he would write the response back from George Washington to the Congress, and then he would write the Congress's response back to George Washington. So he was, you know, he was very close to Washington. He was also very close to Jefferson, served as his Secretary of State, and he ultimately became president. He was probably not the person who really wrote the Constitution. There was a committee of people he was not on that actually wrote the language, but he was instrumental in getting it started and deserves a lot of credit, and I think is an extraordinary person. He, too, was a slave owner. When you think about it, many of our first presidents were slave owners. So think back on it, that these people, what they did, and they came together, they created a country out of whole cloth. And you have to say to yourself, how can we have a country with only 3 million people? And out of those 3 million people, we had George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin. Now we have a country of 330 million people, and we have less. So you have to say, if today there was going to be a constitutional convention under our Constitution, there is a provision to amend the Constitution by amendments from the states, but you can actually have a new constitutional convention. If you were to have a new constitutional convention, who would be the 70 people authorized, the 57 people who might actually show up, or the 39 who actually signed it? You know, clearly we have a lot of talented people in our country. Maybe the most talented ones are not necessarily in government, but you think, you know, all of you could probably put together a list of 30 or 40 people. You would say, I wouldn't mind those people being involved in a constitutional convention. And think about this, 50% of the population was never available to be in the Constitutional Convention before, women. There were no women in the Constitutional Convention, obviously no minorities either, and actually I should say no people were Jewish either. So just imagine if you could have women, people of color, and people who are Jewish in the Constitutional Convention, you know, we'd have a pretty talented Constitutional Convention. But in the end, what these individuals came up with is they created this country, but they had one thing for which they probably have to be criticized for. I can't say I would have done something different if I'd been in that position, but they could not figure out how to deal with our fatal birth defect, and that is slavery. Slavery was something that started in this country by happenstance. When the country was started, there was no slaves. And then a ship of slaves that was headed for Latin America got waylaid, it was ultimately taken over, and some Africans became indentured servants initially, but ultimately began the process of converting indentured servants into slaves. 20 million people from Africa were brought to the Western Hemisphere, 20 million people. 800,000 were brought to the United States. The rest were brought, almost 19 million or so, brought to Latin America. Why more in Latin America? Because they died very quickly. They had to replenish them because of malaria and other working conditions. In the United States, we imported, quote, only 800,000. At the time of the Civil War, there were 4 million slaves because of reproduction and so forth. And think about this. We all have lived through and seen genocide. The Holocaust, what happened in Thailand, what happened in Cambodia with Pol Pot, what happened in China with Mao Zedong, what happened in Russia with Stalin, what happened in Rwanda, what happened in Kosovo. All terrible situations where there was genocide. Genocide is usually something where one or two people at the top and maybe some other senior people get control of a government and they wind up killing people senselessly. It happens for over 4, 5, 10 year period of time, perhaps. Slavery went on for hundreds of years in the United States, and it wasn't a few people at the top. It was tolerated by everybody. And so when the Constitutional Convention was occurring, there were then at that time about 500,000 slaves. We went to 4 million at the time of the Civil War, but 500,000 slaves. It was very important for the Southern economy to basically have slaves, but at the time of the Constitutional Convention, every state authorized slavery. It wasn't until later on that the Northern states got out of slavery. And ultimately, at the Constitutional Convention, no one was willing to tackle the issue of slavery. No one was saying we have to eliminate slavery because they recognized that the Southern states would not come forward and be part of the Union if they were going to eliminate slavery. The people in the North recognized it was morally indefensible. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson knew it was morally indefensible, but they didn't think they could change the system. It was their view that eventually slavery would die out, and ultimately 20 years from now, 30 years from then, 40 years from then, it would die out. And actually, they put a provision in the Constitution that said in 1808, no more slaves could be imported into the United States, and so there would be no more slaves brought in. That was tolerable to the South because they actually had enough slaves, and they just thought that they could reproduce and have more, so they didn't need to import more. And slavery became even more important after the Constitutional Convention because with the invention of the cotton gin, you could then do enormous amounts to produce more cotton with the cotton gin, and you need more slaves to actually pick the cotton. So you had enormous numbers of slaves being brought from the mid-Atlantic states down through the deep south, and probably, you know, half of them died en route, a very tragic situation. Of course, slavery was something where we often talked about people were enslaved, but they was more than being enslaved. They were brutalized, they were raped, they were sodomized, they were hung. It was an extraordinary situation, and it's hard to believe that the founding fathers recognized all this, but they didn't do anything about it. There's nothing. They felt they couldn't do anything about it. They thought it would die out. And so if you look back on the founding fathers and you say, are they overrated or not? I think in the end, they are extraordinary people. Today, we'd be hard-pressed to find as many talented people. How did these people actually come together? There were only 3 million people. How did they come together? Well, remember, if you were one of these 3 million people, you were actually from a very small subset of those 3 million people, because only educated people, more or less, were there, and wealthy people were there. And so these people were people who were committed to making a new country. They were fairly talented, very driven. They recognized that they had to make it work because they probably would be killed ultimately, or they would lose a lot of their property if it didn't succeed. So they were a driven group. They were quite talented, quite educated, but they were they had the weakness of not being able to tackle slavery or tackle Indian issues. At the time, we had hundreds of thousands of Indians living in what was the 13 colonies, and they really did nothing to address that, and ultimately they came up with solutions that basically involved moving the Indians out of our colonies and so forth. So while I you know, say if I were one of the Constitutional Convention people or I'd been in the Declaration of Independence meetings, I'm sure I probably wouldn't have been better than they were. But you have to say, while they're very talented people and they did great things and they deserved a lot of the credit, they did make the mistake in that they blinked on slavery, and ultimately because they blinked, We went to the Civil War where millions of Americans were lost, 6% of our population was killed, and we had the tragedy that really almost broke our country apart. And had the South won, the country would be split in two and be a different country than today. So I wish the founding fathers had been more courageous in dealing with slavery. I recognize their concerns, but in the end, I have to say the founding fathers are not overrated. I think they deserve the credit that they get for putting this country together. And it's hard to think that we could have found other people with as many talents who was willing to sacrifice what they did, sacrifice, and to come together and put together a constitution that has survived some 250 years, plus all the other things they did for us. Thank you. I have 15 minutes of questions. Any questions right here? One question. Are there mics? One here. There's a mic here. Well, okay. Why don't you go, and then you. Go ahead, he has a mic.
So, similar to slavery, over the past several hundred years, what would you say are the problems that we have like that now that we are going to look back on and feel the same way?
Look, you can't compare slavery. You cannot compare slavery to what we have today. But all of us, I grew up in an era of segregated society, more or less. When I grew up in Baltimore, the schools were technically desegregated, but they really weren't. And there was... It was really a more or less segregated society when I was growing up in Baltimore, and much of it was in the United States as well. So I think today we still don't have equality of the races. We don't have equal opportunity. We obviously have enormous income inequality. We have a social underclass that no longer believes, as I believe, that you could rise to the top by working hard. You have many people in the underclass of our society who don't really think they can work. So I think the biggest problem we have, not as tragic as slavery in some respects, but the problem of income inequality, lack of social mobility, and we have a very wealthy upper class and an increasingly poorer underclass, and we don't really have the ability to solve that problem. I think that's our biggest social problem, I think, today, and not quite comparable to slavery, but it's something that our future generations are going to have to solve. We're not going to solve it because it's going to take a generation or two or three to solve this problem. Yes, speak up so I can hear you. Or is there a mic there?
I'm wondering if you can fast forward a little bit to Abraham Lincoln and what gave him the courage to tackle this.
Okay. Abraham Lincoln did not have the courage to tackle this. Abraham Lincoln used to make jokes about blacks. He made jokes about their intellect and their other things. He was a product of a family that had grown up in Kentucky and Indiana, and he didn't think slavery was a good thing, but he wasn't a person who believed that blacks and whites could live together. And in fact, this is hard to believe, but when he was running for president of the United States, at that time, the 13th Amendment, today the 13th Amendment we have is the amendment that eliminates slavery. At that time, President Buchanan wanted to have a 13th Amendment, which had actually passed the Congress. And that 13th Amendment said that Slavery is part of a Constitution of the United States, and it can't be eliminated. And Abraham Lincoln, in his campaign and in his inaugural address, supported that 13th Amendment. So it wasn't as if he was the great emancipator. What actually happened was, when his goal was not, as he always said, to free the slaves. His goal was to keep the Union intact. As the Civil War was going forward, he realized, I can't win this war the way we're doing it now. The slaves in the South are feeding the military engine for the South. We have to get the slaves out of working so hard on behalf of the Southern engine, the military engine, and we also have to find a way to end the war. And he came up with the idea that using his war powers that he more or less invented, that he would issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which would say that in the states that were fighting the South, fighting the Union, slavery was outlawed. It didn't outlaw slavery in the border states or in other states, or just in the ones that we were fighting with. And he used that device as a way of winning the war. Ultimately, when the war was over and coming to be over, he realized you had a lot of emancipated slaves. You couldn't make them slaves again. And what do you do with the slaves in the border states? So he ultimately came relatively late to the idea of supporting the 13th Amendment. He supported it in his reelection campaign, and he fought very hard to get it done before the new Congress came in 1865. But he was not a great emancipator initially. He was a person who came to it very reluctantly. But interestingly, he did philosophically believe that what Thomas Jefferson had written was the most important guiding principle of our country. Thomas Jefferson had written in the Declaration of Independence that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. When Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address, he said, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He got that and took that from Jefferson, who he greatly admired. So I think in his mind, Lincoln thought slavery was unfair, but he never actually thought blacks and whites could really live together. In fact, for most of his career, he said, if we free the slaves, they have to be colonized, which is to say move to Liberia, move to Latin America. And that's what he actually proposed. And even after he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, he called blacks to the White House and said, you know, you should actually move out of the country. Of course, they didn't want to do that. So I would say he deserves a lot of credit for ending slavery, but he didn't come to it as the same way an abolitionist would have. Okay. Yes. Right here.
First of all, I'd just like to say it is always such an incredible treat to have you here.
Okay,
we've been coming up here since he's real little.
All right, well, thank you. All right, thank you.
And I also,
thank you.
We talked about Kennedy's birthday. Let's all join in and wish David Rubenstein his birthday, August 11th, and sing happy birthday.
No, please don't do that.
Come on!
I'm getting older, and I'm trying not to remind myself of my advanced age, but... But thank you very much for that. Questions? Yes. Yes.
Founding mothers.
Yes, let me talk about them. The founding mothers. Obviously, it's hard to believe this, but even in the 20th century, you know, we all were born in the 20th century. Or not all. I think all were all. Everybody here born in the 20th century? Some may be younger. You know, I'm now, I'm chairman of the Duke University board for a couple more days, and I'm actually now looking at how do they recruit basketball players, and I'm really realizing the basketball players they're recruiting are not even born in the same century I was born in. And I'm worrying about what 17-year-olds are going to be deciding to do in terms of college. But anyway, it's the founding mothers, it is hard to believe that in the 20th century we didn't have women voting. And it's hard to believe in the 18th and 19th century, women had virtually no rights. So in those days, the founding mothers are people who were really the spouses of these great founding fathers. The most famous of them, I think, but also most talented, was Abigail Adams. Abigail Adams, we have about 1,000 letters between John and Abigail Adams. And they show a love affair that's hard to understand because he was actually in I should have mentioned John Adams earlier. He was our, of course, second president and one of the most important people in the Revolutionary War and deserves a lot of credit, even though he was not liked by the other people and he was not a slave owner. But he actually spent 10 years abroad, and he still kept up this incredible relationship with his wife. And, you know, many men 10 years away from their wife might not have such a great relationship, but he had a great relationship. And she wrote these letters that show incredible intellect. She wasn't really educated in the traditional sense, but she had real brilliance in many ways and can constrain him. And she wrote the most famous letter of all, which said when they were considering They were considering whether to break away as an independent country and create a country. She wrote to John Adams and said, "Please remember the women," because it was generally thought by Abigail Adams and others that nobody was thinking about the women, their rights and their abilities and so forth. She was not only the mother of a president, John Quincy Adams, but the spouse of a president, but also a great intellect, and her letters are a great part of history. Martha Washington did an incredible job. When George Washington would go into, the way they fought battles in those days, it was a little bizarre when you look at it today. They would fight in the summertime, and then when winter come, they would just sit and do nothing. So they would just sit, like in Valley Forge, he would sit there for 4 or 5 months just doing nothing because they didn't want to fight in the cold, I guess, it was too hard. But she would go with him to every one of these winter encampments, Valley Forge and other places, and she would sew things for the troops. She would cook for the troops. She would do all kinds of things to kind of nurture some of the other soldiers. And so she was incredible. And of course, it was kept up Mount Vernon while he was away for many years as well. There are others, Betsy Ross, who sewed the first flag, Molly Pitcher, who helped in some of the battles. I think Dolly Madison was probably the most famous of the first ladies in some respects because she was, in effect, acting as first lady for Thomas Jefferson because he was widowed and then served as James Madison's first lady. And she really invented really what the first lady does. So they're incredible women, but they weren't well known. I think there's some really good books written by Cokie Roberts about them, and I highly recommend those books about what these founding mothers did and what the early women did in our country because they did contribute a great deal. Yeah. Yes. Yes, sir.
Can you address after Washington's second term, they tried to nominate him for a third term.
Yes.
And he turned it down.
Right.
Because he did not want to make the U.S. a monarchy. And then secondly,
yes.
Can you address the three-fifths rule? The three-fifths rule.
Okay. George Washington, as I said, didn't really want to serve president at all. He agreed to serve as president of the United States. Initially, he thought we'd one term. In a couple months into it, there was an advise and consent provision in the Constitution which said that the Senate had to give advise and consent. Nobody knew what that meant. George Washington went up to the Senate and started talking about his appointees, and he was blistered by some of the senators criticizing him, and he just was so mad that they were criticizing this great man that he thought about resigning right then and there. Ultimately, he was persuaded to stay. And then didn't want to run for re-election, stayed, ran again, elected unanimously again. He was, at the end, he was, as I said, 57 years old. He was not in great physical shape. He had a lot of rheumatism. He had some arthritis. And of course, he had no teeth, really. He had one real tooth, and that one real tooth was used to kind of have a bridge that had these fake teeth. What the teeth? He didn't have wooden teeth. The reason people call it wooden teeth is that he had a dentist in New York called Dr. Greenwood, and often Dr. Greenwood's teeth were called wooden teeth, but they were not. What they did then is this: they took animal teeth and they often mixed it with human teeth, and they put it together in kind of a bridge. You had to have something to anchor it, so you had one tooth, and he anchored it there. That's why you never see a picture of him with smiling, because the teeth didn't look so wonderful. John Adams, the same thing. John Adams had like 3 or 4 teeth, and it looked terrible. You never see a picture of his teeth either. George Washington just had physical problems, and he didn't really want to do the job again, and he also wanted to get back to Mount Vernon. Mount Vernon had some problems, and he thought 2 years was two terms was enough. I'm not sure he specifically said no president should serve more than that, but he wanted to get back. He realized he was probably near the end of his life. And actually, the way he died is tragic, as I have mentioned this to some of you. He went back to Mount Vernon. He rode around, on his 8,000 acres every day. And he was a pretty good horseman even at that age. When he would ride in snow and sleet, and one time he was riding in the snow and the sleet, he came back and there were guests in his house, and people would always go to Mount Vernon to visit the great man, even if they didn't know him. He was a very hospitable person. He would always say, "Yes, I'll have dinner or lunch with you," and that was what the custom was. Well, he didn't want to be impolite, go upstairs and change, so he sat there in kind of wet clothing for a couple hours, got ill, went upstairs. He couldn't really breathe. He got through the night. The next day it was snowing and sleeting again. He went out again, came back, and it was worse. They called the doctors in, and the doctors said there's no real solution other than letting the bad spirits out, cut the blood in your veins and let some bad, that doesn't work. And he kind of went into shock and he couldn't really breathe, and so he died. And interestingly, he said he freed his slaves in his will. One other thing that was interesting in his will, he said, "Don't bury me for 2 days. Why is that? Because he was afraid of being buried alive. Very often the people, the doctors were so bad that they would pronounce somebody dead who wasn't dead. So that's why they put bells in the coffins, and you were supposed to ring the bell. And that's where the phrase dead ringer comes from. You were really on the three-fifths rule. Okay, on the three-fifths rule, the final answer, the three-fifths rule was the compromise. The southern states said, we really feel that the slaves should be counted for purposes of population. And the northern states said, well, you treat these people as property. You say they're property. They're not really humans. How can you say that they should be counted for population purposes? So they came up with a compromise, which basically said that the slaves would count as three-fifths, which gave the southern states and the southern whites much more influence in the Congress, because they're at one point in the Civil War, and before that, slightly, in some states there were more slaves than there were white people. So you had a disproportionate influence in Congress because these people, the slaves, were counting as three-fifths, even though they really weren't given any other rights. So that's how they came up. It was a compromise. No great magical formula to it. I'm out of time, so thank you all very much.